Well, have you ever been stricken with the fact that you believe there's only one way or certain ways that we can support our child with autism? Have you been so attached to this is the only way and this is the only thing that's out there? And then feeling like, well, these things aren't working, and what do we do? I'm here to tell you that today we are going to open up that discussion even more. We definitely have had those conversations on the podcast in different arenas, but today we're going to have it in a much more broader way with a very, very special guest. So hang tight, and we'll be right back.
When you become a mom, you never imagine your child getting an autism diagnosis. It feels like your dreams have shattered, like a framed photograph falling off your mantle, exploding into a thousand pieces. But instead of trying to glue those pieces back together, this community of moms is here to help you build a new dream, a better one. So join in the conversation as us moms talk autism.
Okay, so today we have Jonathan Alderson. He is the founder and director of an integrative multi-treatment intervention program for autism acceptance and development. He's a master's in education. Jonathan offers customized solutions that specializes in blending all of the multidisciplinary therapies that are out there that include play-based therapy, structured learning, ABA, sensory, and biomedical treatments in a very integrated model. With a master's from Harvard University and the experience in Texas as a curriculum specialist coordinator with Teach for America, which, hello, that's from me, which, by the way, I should say, we have some other hosts on the show today. It will be myself, Jean, and Natasha, and Shannon.
Hi, guys.
Circling back to Jonathan before we fully introduce him. He did that for about 8 years at the Autism Treatment Center of America, in Massachusetts, the Sunrise program, which some of us here on the podcast were already familiar with prior to, and where he worked as the administrator and senior family trainer. He's worked with over 3,000 families over a span of 25 years and across the world. So not limited to obviously here in the US or even in Canada, where he currently resides, but worked in UK, Ireland, Holland, Spain, Australia, Israel, and Mexico. He serves as the chair of the professional advisory committee of the Seneca College Behavioral Science Program, and was the editor of a book for Autism 101, and is personally the author of the Challenging the Myths of Autism, which we have all had the privilege of reading in a great, significant manner. And we will reference today on the podcast for many talking points. And the most other, I would say, is when we've talked with Jonathan, the thing he was the most proud of was a tool that he created that is accessible to any and all families, which was it's an online tool that's accessible to reach more families through one of a kind, what's called the Thrive Guide online parent resource. And if we don't jump into it on today's episode, don't worry, because we're going to do two episodes with Jonathan. So with all that said, Jonathan, you have the floor. Anything else that you would like to give even more of personal background on? We're so proud and happy to have you here with us today. There's so much to talk about. We could talk, even when we talked with you initially, we could talk with you for hours. So even though we'll try to keep this to an hour today, we'll see.
We'll
We'll see.
see.
We'll see how we all behave well.
We'll see what
Exactly.
happens.
So.
Thank you for the introduction, guys. I'm excited to be. I've been looking forward to it since our first conversation, which I think we all agreed we potentially could have recorded as an episode, because we just dove in very quickly and comfortably to some important and interesting conversations with your experiences as moms, doctor moms, as they call them, professional PhD moms, and my experience. I'm really looking forward to the conversation.
Yes, doctor moms. Mm-hmm. We didn't call ourselves doctor. We used to say, because I've worked for Texas Parent to Parent, we call ourselves medical moms. And I do medical mom training for first and second year residents. I don't ever want to say that I'm the doctor, but we are reluctant as experts. So we do often use that term very regularly here within this group. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I remember you talking about the program that you're involved in and what you do with parents to train them and educate them. And it's just so important. It's a terrific program.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well done.
We'll be able to talk about that. Maybe also we want to have the supervisor that I work with from the program on to actually talk about that more in depth on our podcast. Let's talk about exactly. Look, it's a little bit of history here, right? Because for our listeners to understand how we've went from A, you've gotten from A to B, where you kind of started when you entered this world of researching autism, because that's what you are at the heart of it. You are a researcher. And I can tell you, even reading your book, the way that you write and the way you deliver information, it totally stimulates what is the most compelling thing about it. And I think the most important thing for without skipping forward, but it really keeps people's curiosity going. It stimulates their brain to be curious and not fixed to a certain way, method, or approach of how we should be treating or supporting our kids on the spectrum. And so, but that's not where you started out. You kind of started out kind of exiting education and being a master's in a certain arena with a certain way of directional thinking. So if you wanted to kind of expand on that, and that actually will allow people to really kind of get a holistic view of like the work you've done. And
Yeah, sure. Thank you. And I'll share a couple of pieces that are important that fit into how we got to the multi-treatment approach. Because there's lots of steps along the way, but there were some key steps that led to that. And I'll take you back to my undergrad, where I had quite an interest. I was in a psychology program, sort of a concurrent psychology education and French program. And in psychology, developmental psychology specifically, I was very interested in how do little children grow up and develop? And in particular, how could they grow up to be contributing kind of citizens? I was always interested on the social side. How could we be good neighbors? How could we raise children to have sort of morals and ethics and that kind of stuff? I was less the sort of the STEM, the kind of the math and science guy. I enjoyed sciences, but in terms of what would be important to raise children. And along that path, I started very much becoming interested in the biology of learning, right? So there's the behavior of learning, being a teacher, how to do a lesson plan, how to get kids to sit down in a desk. But then there's also how does learning actually happen in the brain, in the body? So when some sound goes in the ears and the teacher says, please sit down, crisscross applesauce or whatever it is, what happens? What neurons actually fire and what happens? So I took some courses there, and that was important along the way. What happened for me is coming out of undergrad, I had the chance to go down to Massachusetts from Canada to a center. And at this center, it was the Autism Treatment Center of America. And I went down there to check it out. I remember seeing, I think, for the first time in my life. Looking back, I think it was the first little child diagnosed with autism that I had seen up to this point. Even though, by the way, I had studied special needs in different ways on a diagnostic level and things, it was all in books. So here I was, and I was looking through this two-way mirror in a therapy room, and this little boy was running around a little table that had some Lego pieces or puzzle pieces on it. And he looked like he was having a lot of fun. It was a play-based approach. So you had this therapist. I remember her clearly chasing him around in a fun, playful way. And all of a sudden, he would sit under the table. Looked like he was hiding. So I thought, okay, he's playing hide and seek. But he wouldn't come out. And he just sat there. And then he covered his ears. And I turned to the person who was standing, one of the staff with me, and I said, hey, why is he covering his ears like that? And she said, we don't know. He's probably sensitive to hearing, but we don't, you know, guy asked a couple of other questions. Yeah, but why is he doing that? And we don't really know. So then he stood up and he pointed at something on the shelf and started to cry. And I said, why is he crying? Because she's getting that thing down for him that he wanted. We don't know, was the answer. And over the last half an hour, there were so many questions I had about what the heck is going on with this little boy and so many we don't knows yet. Remember, this is decades ago. What that did is it ignited a fire in me of curiosity to want to understand what is going on with this little guy and just really just to know. So I went to the library, started reading. I went online. I looked and looked and started to learn about autism. I decided to join a training program where at the center, and it was the Sunrise program, which is a play-based program. Probably many of your listeners are familiar, at least, with the approach. They focus a lot on the attitude or the feeling that goes with, you know, having a relationship, a parent-child relationship, which I think was really formative. But while I was based at the Sunrise program, and I learned a lot, and they do phenomenal work, but being the curious guy was, I went out, began to go to other kinds of conferences, and so on and so forth. And what was just happening at that time in the early 90s was the DAN movement, the Defeat Autism Now movement, the biomedical movement. Bernard Rimland was coming out with his papers and really trying to create a movement of medical doctors and people that would look at the biomedical treatment and the biomedical aspect, if you will, of autism. And I will say, footnote, there's been a lot of ups and downs in that. There's been a lot of, I think, left-hand turns and dead ends for parents. But there's also has been some important research done and some important considerations there. And so I'll sort of shorten up the story and say that was one example of some other trainings and learnings I did outside of the Sunrise program, again, which is important for me that as a center, sort of a play-based model, relationship-based model, love, respect, acceptance of difference, very important as a foundation. And here's what happened is I felt that I leaned in very much to parents I was working with, and I would ask some questions like, hey, what else are you doing outside of the program I'm teaching you? What's working? And I started to hear from parents all of the day, hey, we're doing equestrian therapy. We have a guide dog. We're doing swimming lessons. Music has been terrific. This particular supplement or diet really helped my child. Massage seems to be really good. And I heard so many things out there. And I was left with one observation and one question that has led me to what I do today. One observation was, oh my gosh, parents, moms like you have to coordinate all of this on their own. There is no map for them. There's no coordination strategy for that. They're running between different treatments. They have to decide which to do. They have to sometimes, I mean, I heard stories from parents saying, we're doing play therapy and behavior therapy, but don't tell each of them. Because if they knew that I was working with this person, they would stop working with me or get mad. And so can you imagine, well, you can, a parent who's put in that situation to have to somehow not either be honest or upfront or to coordinate services for fear of losing a service. It just really didn't feel right to me. So that was the observation, that there was a need for some kind of map or coordination around the multi-treatment things that all parents I'd worked with were doing. Mm-hmm. And the second is, it was really clear to me that some parents had either by luck or by smartness or whatever, had found the right combination for their child of things, but many hadn't. Mm-hmm. And for those many who hadn't, the majority who were on a sort of trial and error, hunt and find what's going to work for my child basis, they were wasting a lot of precious development time. Mm-hmm. And they were wasting a lot of precious resources. Mm-hmm. As you know, some parents double mortgage their houses because they're sort of going from one expensive treatment to the other. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was not fair, not right. It doesn't make any sense to me. Mm-hmm. So I left that particular position, again, on great terms and really felt great about that. But after 8 years, it was my time to go and figure out, if I could, how we could do multi-treatment programs for parents to, A, relieve from them that burden of having to figure out, you know, how do I coordinate all of this? And B, how do I know what to choose that's going to best work for my unique individual child, that there's no one like this child on earth. There's patterns. Yes, there's a population. Yes, there's research. But this individual, this particular constellation of challenges and strengths and needs and our family resources, that profile has to be really, really looked at and considered what makes sense for this child.
Yes.
So that's what I do. That's where so we came good. To.
I would that's also so wanted to layer in there, or even just like, say that I'm going to question that this is a part of your conversations with parents, because this wasn't just then. This is still relevant now as much as it was then, because so many of our families in our community don't know when. And some of them, so some people wanted to try out a therapy and they tried it out once and then it was such a bad experience, they've written it off. I've advised sometimes like it's okay to take a break from that, recalibrate and revisit. It doesn't mean that that therapy is probably something to pursue. It was that the actual practitioner that was implementing the therapy or someone within the practice was not, it was how, not the what. And kind of delineating and deciphering between that, which is another layer. So, okay, so you're going to get the constellation, the map, and the scaffolding of like, maybe this is what we would recommend for your child based on the information that you've provided and we've gathered and observed, et cetera, et cetera. But there's another layer to that. And even underneath that layer as well, or kind of in tandem with that layer, is healthcare, like the health insurance aspect versus non-insurance and providers that also don't take or accept insurance, and navigating all of that. These add all these additional layers that the parents and the caregivers are navigating, and depending also on their socioeconomic status, where they're living, all those environmental factors, it's very nuanced. In addition to just, if we were just dealing with, let's look at what's best for my kid, it's not as simple even as that, as like distilling it down to.
No, it's not. And I 100% align with what you're saying. It's so insightful. The intake portion of the work that I do, it starts with a 16-page intake. It's pretty long. Mm-hmm. And it has some of the questions that y'all are familiar with from all of the other intakes you've done: name, date of birth, what's the diagnosis of your child. But we get quickly into what workplace environment do you work in, for example, as parents. Are you in a hazardous waste environment, an office environment? How long do you work? How many hours are you at home? What's your relationship like with your spouse? What kind of food do you keep in your refrigerator? How often do you guys do exercise? I mean, we go into all of that, and you're right, in terms of even socioeconomic status. What part of the country do you live in? Mm-hmm. What's your insurance provider offer or not? It starts with the intake, by the way, with that form. And then we go into observations. I show up at the house. I look, I watch. and see all sorts of things that you don't get on an intake. Mm-hmm. I remember sitting, going into one family. And as I sit there, this was back when we all had DVDs and not Netflix, but it was good because then you could really see what the kids are watching. And I remember sitting down in the living room and there was literally sort of like a Library of Congress wall of videos. Like they had a large, probably the largest collection I've ever seen of Disney movies. And so, you know, that led to the conversation. So how many of these has your child watched, and how many times? Some of these covers look pretty worn. And you know, where the conversation went pretty quickly is this child had a digital addiction to sitting, as many children do. It has nothing to do with autism necessarily. And this little guy really was, you know, he would sit and play a certain segment back and forth, play reverse, and that kind of stuff. So we really got into conversation. But I think what you're saying is key here, which is, you know, every family, not just every child, every support unit, every family has their own unique situation. Listen, I remember seeing, I don't know if I shared this with you guys, but just as another end of the spectrum, we had a video sent to our team to review, to do a parent coaching. And I get, you know, a bit emotional when I tell this still to this day, because it was so touching to think this is when we pressed play on the video, it was a video in a family's trailer where they lived. And it was the bed at the back of the trailer. They had one room, one bed. They had little curtains drawn. And the father was on his knees because that's how much height they had in the bed space. And that's where he was doing therapy with his little boy who was standing there. And the mom was filming and sent us the film. And I'm sorry, it does get me, because here is a family who has almost no resources. This is their home. This is where they're living. I have no judgment of that. It's that they were so deeply invested, like every family I've met, to do what they could do in this little tiny bed, the back of, you know, and they literally explained, in the morning we get up, we make the bed, we move stuff, and that becomes our playroom, if you will, for him. And they were trying to do it, and they wanted feedback and input, and it's all they could do to afford this consultation. We obviously said, hey, by the way, zero charge for this consultation. How else can we help you? But when you advise or direct a program like that, you have to take all of those pieces into consideration. Yeah. What are they dealing with? What are they living with?
So important. So you currently still are obviously servicing families in that way, correct? You have a team.
So over the last 5 years, my practice of working directly with families has definitely shrunk for a number of reasons, just in terms of where my focus is. So I work with only about four families right now, one in Ireland, one in Vancouver on our west coast of Canada, and two in Toronto. And I put my focus into, I think you mentioned it in the intro there, the Thrive Guide, which is an online platform. And the reason to limit the families I'm working with so intensely is so that we can build this platform to reach out, we hope, to tens of thousands more families with some of the information and approach that we take.
Yeah.
So
good.
One thing that we mentioned when we're getting in our initial discussions too, but and obviously it was also referenced in part of your book, and I think still is kind of diving a little bit into like the history of the diagnostic criteria around autism and how that all came to be and how those things when that were established, you know, back when, I mean, I'll say 1940s because, you know, per record and Kanner, that's what's there, but that's not where it all derived from. And it came from a little old Jewish lady in Russia. That had members of her research team that ended up working for Kanner's team and then also worked for Hans Asperger's team. Okay, so this was all shared information and they adopted a lot of these concepts, but that woman never actually got the credit because hence what was going on in the world.
Often the case, right? We know that there's been movies made about the women behind the space race who got credit, sadly, decades later. Mm-hmm. So it's often the case that a male steps up and takes the credit.
We're not shocked about any of that. I think if we can have a little bit of a discussion about that, because obviously that could totally be its own episode in general, but I think some of the key factors, especially for, if let's say you're a newly diagnosed family, or even if you're kind of, you know, middle of the road here, is understanding that many of what's established now is still kind of even in infancy stages, right? But there are things that were established in that previous diagnostic criteria that have not been wiped the slate, has not wiped the slate clean, and is still kind of like pervasive, and like the thinking and mindset around autism and how that impacts and drives how parents make decisions, perhaps that they don't realize necessarily, and how you help parents or help families navigate that, or how you see that show up. And obviously any interesting factoids that you want to share, because I actually didn't know about the other group of women, because it was two women after Canner that came up with the other three levels of criteria. I didn't, that triad.
Mm-hmm. The triad of autism.
Which I found interesting, because I didn't know about them. Like, that was never on my radar. I never knew about them.
That was in England, yeah.
But I found that to be interesting. But I think just how that still has relevance. And obviously there's not all bad, because some of the things that existed, like you said, there are things that still have merit. It's not saying it's null and void, it doesn't matter anymore. We just didn't know what we didn't know. And now we know more, and we know other things. So,
yeah. You know, I'll jump in and just for full disclosure, I'm not a diagnostician. So I don't diagnose autism, and that's important. And I tell parents that. Obviously get calls sometimes to say, what do you think? Should I go for a diagnosis? And sometimes people get a diagnosis and they're questioning it and want a second opinion. Mm-hmm. And I'm really clear. I'm not a medical doctor. I don't diagnose autism. My focus is on the treatment side, the education side. Mm-hmm. So now what? What do we do? And I'm going to answer your question, but in this way, which is, because my focus is on how to best help a child develop, how to maximize their learning, how to help them thrive. To be honest, I'm really less interested in the diagnostic labels, and I'm more interested in I'm going back to the individual again. You know, and individual child's challenges. This particular child seems to reverse letters and words. Is there dyslexia? And we know that there's so many issues, challenges, neurological differences, diversity that exists comorbid or alongside autism. In fact, you know, that's really where I think most parents end up getting traction, good help, is when they start looking with specialists, looking at vision or looking at coordination with an occupational therapist, or looking at writing skills or language skills with an SLP. And, you know, that sort of broader autism therapist, autism category is often not as useful. So just as a starting point to think about for parents out there, the conversation that I start with, some of the questions you raised around what do you know about autism and how is that helping or hindering you to help your child? That's really what it is. That's a starting point.
So
you sit down and I might say to a mom and a dad, hey, just as a starting point, how about you guys tell me what you understand about autism and in regards to your child? And what I try and do in that listening is I'm trying to listen for beliefs that they have about their child that they've been sold, bought, that they've been told by, you know, well-intentioned professionals, beliefs that a parent holds that is going to get in their way of helping their child.
Absolutely.
Does that make sense? So, yes. Sort of a limiting
block. Oh my gosh. Yes.
Shannon and I did an right? episode on
and
that.
And so that's what I'm sort of listening for. And so just to as an example, over the first kind of 15 years of my work in the field, remember I told you that I was going to different conferences and I was reading a lot and learning a lot, but at the same time, I was working 8-10 hour days directly with parents in their homes and at the center. And there was this very big delta mm-hmm. between what I was reading and learning about autism and what I'd see. Mm-hmm. So I would read this sentence over and over again in literature, in reports and things that 90, this is a fact, 90% of children with autism have mental retardation, mm-hmm. have a below 60 IQ. Mm-hmm. And I would see that everywhere in well-established science reports. But I would see with my own eyes up close the intelligence mm-hmm. of most, many, all on some level, in some capacity, in some way, unique intelligences, diverse, sometimes fascinating, interesting, way beyond my understanding of intelligence of many of the children I worked with who were on the spectrum. And that was just one example of something that wasn't congruent, something that didn't go together. And I was keeping, I had these little, I don't know if people use them anymore, but recipe cards that your mom would write recipes on and file away. So I had a stack of those and I was writing examples that would refute the statistics that I read in research. I just mm-hmm. write examples like, oh, today I was with little Billy and he knew how to count by fours. He was only 2 years old and he could count by fours up to 1,000, you know, something like this, mm-hmm. like these sort of, and I would write these examples down. And about 8, 9, 10 years after writing all, I mean, stacks of these, it occurred to me, you know, I've really identified at this point at least 10 different, what I would call myths of autism, mm-hmm. stereotypes of autism. And I have all of these stories to refute it. And at that time, I had by then found a lot of evidence and research, published research to refute them. So I decided to write the book, Challenging the Myths of Autism. Mm-hmm. And as you know, because you guys have a copy, there's 7 chapters and each chapter is a different myth. And by the way, one of them is the myth of intelligence. Mm-hmm. And I go into debunking that statistic that is passed down almost from generation to generation through psychologists and doctors and researchers. And I show where it came from. Oftentimes it's almost a fluke or a silly way that it mm-hmm. happened to come. But the sad thing is how they're passed down from generation to generation mm-hmm. to parent. Mm-hmm. And they get in the way because if you're a parent, and I tell this story, here's just a quick example. It's in the book. You might have read it. I remember actually feeling both angry and on the verge of tears when I came across this post one evening when I was researching the book, and I was on a parent's blog post, and I was reading different posts, and this one mom had posted, she said, this is on the evening of my child's 5th birthday, and I'm basically here, and I'm sad, and I'm depressed, and I'm mad at myself because I've let my kid down because he doesn't yet talk. And I know, right, she writes, I know that if your child doesn't talk by the age of 5, they probably never will. Mm-hmm. So I'm reading this, and of course I want to jump through the screen, the computer screen, you know, or find her, say, wait a minute. No, don't believe that. That's not true. That's actually not what the evidence shows us. Mm-hmm. There is some truth that most neurotypical children gain their language before 5. That's absolutely, totally true. But it is not true that if your child doesn't talk at 5, that he never will. Yes. And it's also not true that you let your child down. Please don't believe that. And there she was really saying, reaching out for help on this mommy blog. Can somebody help me? I feel depressed. You know, I'm angry at myself. So those stories are what drives me to want to break the myths, challenge the myths, whatever you want to call it, of autism that limit what we believe about our children, limit what we might try, and that puts huge burdens on moms, like mm-hmm. that guilt.
I think too mm-hmm. paradoxical, like the dichotomy between you're looking at the treatment and the now what, but what also drives that is the diagnostic material, right? And so,
100%.
And because that also, especially because the majority of people are, if they are doing anything privatized, they're not going through the school system. And even if you're going through the school system, that's a whole nother part of it too, is that it's driven by all of these parameters around boxes that have to be checked to meet certain criteria, right? And so a lot of the observations that you even have in your book, because it does refute some of what the diagnostic criteria says that determines or defines what an autistic child is, or a specific behavior of that child. If a child has another comorbidity of like Tourette's, or has a emotional disturbance or a mood disorder, or OCD or ODD or any of those things,
ADHD. Like
any of those things, they all have criteria that then in order for those parents to get access to those treatments, they have to meet that certain criteria. Like I say, that's a treatment that you're going to recommend, right? They have to be able to get access to that treatment through their health insurance based on that criteria. And that's like,
Very, very, very. You're absolutely right. Like you said, we could do a whole episode. We could have a whole discussion on this. It's very deep and it's very important, and it could be a starting point. Mm-hmm. Right? It could be a starting point. We showed up today to talk about multi-treatment, which is on the treatment side. Mm-hmm. But you're right. What drives those decisions to treatment mm-hmm. is the diagnosis. I would take it a step even back, Jean, even more, which is what drives diagnosis is largely how you define what the problem is.
Yes.
What we call problematizing.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so the standard definition at the top of almost every website on autism, or almost every book, or almost every chapter, your parents, you've read this sentence thousands of times or hundreds of times, which is autism is a neurological disorder that's lifelong. You know, that sentence mm-hmm. that sort of defines it. Mm-hmm. That's your starting point. So if you believe that it's just neurological, mm-hmm. if you believe that it is this and this and this and this, then that's what you go hunting for.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
If it said autism is a challenge that many children face of neurodiversity with different ways of thinking and different ways of being, and they often have incredible talents, but they're also really challenged with some of these, you would have a different diagnostic process.
Yes.
And we'd actually, part of it would be go hunting for their strengths.
Yes.
And you guys have heard of yeah. the idea of a strengths-based approach and so mm-hmm. on and so forth. So how you define it is important. What happened in my journey and what I try and pass on to parents is when we talk about multi-treatment, you'll see on my website, which is looks like a 1980s website, needs an overhaul.
INTI.ca.
One of the things it says there weren't. Okay. That's how old it was. That's how old
just
it is.
Making sure everyone's paying attention.
That's right. There's a little mouse in the back that's running on a treadmill yeah. to still like kind of make it electrified. But on there, I start with this premise. And what you're saying is so right on the money, which is I start with, I believe and I teach that autism is a multifactorial challenge.
Yes.
Therefore, the treatment should be multifactorial as well. Mm-hmm. And in this conversation, we could insert, if autism is multifactorial, meaning that there's many different pieces at play in the child's mm-hmm. whole being, mm-hmm. there's a physiology, there's an emotional component, there's a psychological component, there's a behavioral component, there's the family environment component, all the mm-hmm. things we've been talking about. If that's true, then the diagnosis, going right back to what we talked about, right, with the intake form, the diagnosis should be multi-treatment and multifactorial. We should be looking what we're talking about, what economic status, what's the education, where do you live, what's the environment, all this kind of stuff. And treatment should be multi-treatment as well.
Yes.
That just to me is logical.
See, yes. Yeah. Yes. Yes. I just have to say, we have so many parents in our community that come to us and they say, I just got my diagnosis, or I haven't received it yet. What should I do? What, I mean, the doctors or the hospital or whoever diagnosed, you know, they just kind of left me out in the cold. Should my child be in ABA or should they be in the school district? You know, there's just that immediate rush of, which is understandable. You know, people's mindset is that they don't want to cure it, but they want to do anything they can to help, you know, their child succeed. And getting away from that mindset. Yes, we all want our children to succeed, whether they are divergent or typical, whatever it might be. But it isn't a one size fits all. It's just right. Not. It's just not, you know? And
so what do you say to them, right? What do you say to parents that says, what should I do?
Yes. Yeah.
So here's what I think is the number one mistake that we all make, all of us, all the therapists, the doctors, parents. And sadly, it's the number one myth that keeps being propagated. Exactly what we were talking about. It comes from how we frame out autism. And it's this, number one, is we keep talking about the behavior of the autistic child. Mm-hmm. And the focus is so much on change the behavior. And I think it distracts us massively. Okay, so if you see my child isn't developing in the ways that they should be, or they're being different and I'm concerned, and you go, the focus on the treatment side, by the way, the diagnosis is almost entirely behavioral, as we know, that meaning they're measuring the behavior of the child, but the focus becomes you got to change this kid's behavior.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. He's got to behave differently and then he'll be better. And here's the answer. Sorry to disappoint people, but no, that teaching a child to sit in a chair or to draw a circle behaviorally may or may not, likely won't really have a massive impact on what's going on for them developmentally. So yes. That's the very first thing as they try and do a shift. And you actually just said something, Natasha, which I think is insightful. I'm not sure if you caught it, but you said, we all want our children to have success to succeed. Mm-hmm. I would agree with that. That's very different than changing behavior.
Mm-hmm. Yes. What is successful for our child? Yes. Yeah.
Our child and success and thriving is different.
Yes. So
just to break it down though, if your listeners are saying, okay, so what's the answer? What should I do? In all of the years of multi-treatment, and I want to make this clear, guys, there's something we haven't talked about that's so, so important. I'm going to throw another card on the table here, and that's order and timing. Mm. And that's a multi-treatment program doesn't mean go and find as many different things possible that you can do and create a sort of, you know, house salad, a mixed salad of all this stuff and try and do lots of stuff. Parents are already doing that.
Yes.
I said that at the beginning. That was one of the things I saw. So what I've tried to figure out over the years, and I'm not saying I have the answer for every child, but what I tried to figure out is there patterns and is there a system of what we could follow in order to, if we go back for a moment, and if we agree that my child will likely need a variety of supports, a question is, and you just asked it, how do I know where to start? How do I know which one? I have limited resources. My husband and I can pick two or one or 3 hours worth or whatever. Where do we start? And it turns out that, well, I believe that there is an order and a timing that you want to follow. And I'll give you the first step that we apply for every child we work with, even though they're all different and unique. And the place that we start is with an idea that is well established in science, in both education and psychology and developmental psychology, behavioral sciences. And that is this. Please write this down. The principle is that learning is a biological process. You want to help your child to learn. 100% of parents agree with that. That's what we're all doing, whether it's behavioral learning, cognitive learning, emotional learning, but it's a biological process. Mm-hmm. Okay. So just for listeners who may not understand exactly what I mean by that, I mean that at the end of the day, your brain and all of the senses that take in learning, right? So data goes in the eyes and data goes in the ears and data goes in the nose and the mouth and the skin. That's how your brain learns, is by taking in information from the environment, whether it's a teacher or a therapist or the world teaching your kid things. And that happens through your nervous system. And the nervous system runs on molecules and what we call the axon potential, and it's an exchange between different molecules. Won't go into it, right? But there's plus and there's positive and negative ions that go along an axon, a dendrite, and it passes a message on, like a messenger, all the way up to the brain from the eyes or the ears or whatever. So if you're saying to your child, hey, Jason, go get your running shoes on. For him to hear that sound and it hits the tympanic membrane in the ear, and then it triggers some dendritic, these nerves, goes up into the brain, and that's all a biological process. So why is this important? If you understand that learning is a physical or biological process, then in my mind, the place to start with a child who's struggling with learning is to first check out, diagnose, ensure that the child's physiology is at its optimal capacity, that's optimized, it's maximized. That's the first place that we start, is we do a deep dive, as deep as a family can afford or knows or has resources for, to start looking at, is my child's physiology and the elements of the body, the parts of the body that are deeply involved in learning, are they optimized? That's a starting point. Don't spend tens of thousands of dollars on piano lessons if you have chronic migraine headaches and you can't pay attention to the piano lessons. I'm saying for all of us, you wouldn't do that. If you had a throbbing headache and you had booked a $70 piano lesson, you wouldn't show up. You'd cancel. You'd save your money. And you'd say, hey, listen, I'm not going to get a lot of value out of this $70 piano lesson. I need to take care of my headache. I'm going to go do that first, because I know that for me to really benefit from this lesson, which I want to do, I need to be in some level of optimal kind of operation here physically. We know that, right? But our children who have special needs and often communication challenges are often not able to tell us, I'm not at an optimal level here today, Mom, for this ABA session that you're paying for and I'm going to for the next 3 hours. I'm not ready to learn. My body isn't lined up here. They often can't tell us that. But we're so focused on behavior and behavior change and ABA and this stuff that we just keep going through often months and years of this. And there can be underlying issues that last for years that aren't resolved.
There's three things I want to say. And one of the things was that your role, and this is like because I'm a systems person and because it's always for me about advocacy, is you are in a position that you then have to demystify and break down. It's almost counterproductive. You're getting the parents after they went through this thing. And now they're also in a state of trauma too, right? And you're having to carry them through this. But if we had a system that from the very beginning already cultivated this kind of process naturally, you know, we wouldn't be here trying to like basically even put a Band-Aid on the situation or try to figure out how we're going to repair and all this stuff moving forward. But like Shannon and I did an episode on that, like where your operating system is as a parent, where you're operating from. So your values, your beliefs, the trauma that you've had in your efforts of advocacy really are driving some of the outcomes that you're having with your kid. And those are hard conversations to have with parents or get them to identify that in order to be like, is this again, is this a hindrance? Is identifying like what it is, like when it's a hindrance to them and how to get them to move forward.
100%. You're talking about, again, going back to what are the beliefs that you hold about this, but you're now adding on a piece, which is parents' emotional and mental, you know, well-being that's often not addressed. And again, I'm suggesting to you, one of the reasons is, the number one reason is we focus so much on the child's behavior. I said to you that a starting point is the physiology of the child. But now I will tell you that the real starting point, the very first question that I ask a parent when I sit and meet with them, when the timing is right, by the way, because you have to have some rapport to ask this question. Before we get into change, in fact, I often say to a family, hey, listen, you've hired me to help your child change. That's why I'm sitting in your living room or we're on the phone. That's what you're wanting. That's why you called me up. Before we talk about change and changing your child, I'd like to ask you a question. Your child has an autism diagnosis. How are you feeling? Mm-hmm. What's going on for you? How do you feel about that?
Mm-hmm. And this is why we have the podcast.
Now, you can imagine that you can imagine, right? Some people, the tears just start flooding out and they'll say, thank you for asking me that. No one has asked me that. Sometimes they look at you like you're from another planet. How am I feeling about that? What do you think? How do you think I'm feeling? Kind of like they're sort of affronted. I say, hey, listen, I've heard 1,000 answers to that question. Mm-hmm. And what I'm interested in is what your answer is. And I'm doing this because I want to give you a chance to simply say it out loud if that's something that is comfortable for you and would be useful. If you don't want to talk about it, I super respect that. But that conversation of how do you feel about what's going on, before we talk about change, before we talk about running the marathon, to your point, Jean, you know, I do often meet a family when they're halfway through the journey, right, or they've already been told all this stuff. By the way, I have to say to people, I'm everyone's first, second choice. People go to ABA first, as we know, right? You come out of the doctor's office and they say, go do it, do ABA. And by the way, that's fantastic for a lot of kids. But so after a year or two of trying a special diet or ABA or whatever, parents do start looking for other things outside of what they're told. It's like, this is kind of working, but kind of not. There must be something different. Where do I go? What do I look for? And then sometimes some parents bump into a guy named Jonathan Alderson, who they say, you know what? He kind of has some insights and looks at things a little bit differently. So I'm kind of people's first, second choice. But you're right. So there's a lot of sometimes undoing. There's a lot of going back and right back to the beginning
and repair.
And it's a lot of work
for those parents to even get the respite and the space for that recovery time at times, because sometimes they're incurring things at a highly incessant rate that's just not letting up. And those things impact them. Mm-hmm. When you were talking about, and I'm so glad you said this, and I think Shannon did write it down because I didn't have a pen with me to write it down, that it's a biological process. This is so relevant because that's all kids. Like, that's all kids. We don't realize that. We're not willing to even recognize that in just a typical learner, which I have noticed, as well as this non-typical learner, right? There's atypical learner. And if one of the things I learned from one of our BCBAs was, you cannot teach a kid that is not HRE. And I said, what is HRE? And she said, happy, released, and engaged. And that's the acronym, I feel like, that is the overarching that explains the process that you just explained. That is a biological process. And if those things are not being approached, which is why it makes it so hard, and I want to bring you to the systematic problem, is that there's such a, this, I guess, like siloed theories about things that are only medically essential for our kids versus educationally. And the answer is that it's always been both. And so I feel like your job as a researcher, because you have all this information, is to be like, we have to take this information and drive systems. And you wrote it in the book. You wrote it. I forget which chapter you wrote it in, but it was like, our jobs as educators, medical professionals, policymakers, is to recognize these things, that this is what's actually impacting and driving treatment for kids.
Right. And by the way, let's just, because you've been talking about history, and this is interesting. So there will be a number of listeners, I think, here today, and maybe professionals saying, hey, but wait a minute. We know that applied behavioral analysis is the most studied, the most researched, the most evidence-based practice. And Lovaas got it right. We have stuff, you know, some really great evidence about that. And I want to be really clear. I am pro anything that will help a child and not harm them, mm-hmm. and that has evidence base. And so we use a lot of ABA in our practice. But what I want to do just for a second here is to go back in history and say, here's what Lovaas got right. Dr. Ivar Lovaas, right? Mm-hmm. UCLA, sort of kind of the grandfather of taking applied behavioral analysis and bringing it into a treatment for children with autism. Mm-hmm. That's that guy there. And here's what he got right. He got correct that he understood, by the way, and I can say this because I've read a lot of his papers. Mm-hmm. And I went back when I was researching the book and read a lot of what he wrote. And he got it correct. And he understood that learning is a biological process. Mm-hmm. And he understood the science of behavior. Hence applied behavioral analysis, reinforcement and different contingencies and reinforcement schedules and so on and so forth. There's a lot there. Here's what he got wrong, or at least didn't address. And there's two things that we talked about. One is, yes, learning is a biological process and you could affect behavior in these ways, but you can't assume that the physiology of the learning process is healthy. Mm-hmm. So in other words, with all of the, I think it was 19 in his original study, 17, 19, I'd have to go back to the number, but it was almost assumed like, hey, if we just put in these schedules of reinforcement, we do this stuff, they're going to learn. But they didn't stop to say, well, wait a minute, it takes a certain amount of hydration in the body. It takes like water. It takes a certain amount of nutrients. It takes a certain amount of calcium and a certain amount of oxygen and so on and so forth for the body to work. And is that working with these children? Yeah, maybe behavior isn't an issue if we got their physiology right. So he got that wrong, or at least he didn't focus on it. And so we have an entire field of study, BCBAs, ABAs, the entire shebang, who are racing ahead trying to change behavior and not pausing to say, wait a minute, are the mechanics of the learning in place? Okay. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing I got wrong. But here's the second thing, and this is just maybe will take us in a different direction, but it's really important. I said that the very first, like, what's the order that we look at in multi-treatment? I said the first one was learning is physical, right? Learning is a biological. Number two is that what we call in our practice the therapeutic alliance, but basically the relationship between the teacher and the child or the teacher and the parent is absolutely 100% totally the catalyst, or it's the block to learning. So let's say you have the body aligned and the body's ready and the child is kind of in maximal shape to learn physically. But if they don't get along with that teacher, mm-hmm. or if there's a lot of friction with mom and dad, or if that teacher's not inspiring, motivating, or whatever, that's going to get in the way of learning. And so what we know, if we go back and looked at Lovaas's early studies, he had not a lot of insight in writing about that. That, hey guys, the way that we approach these kids, yes, the principles of behavior apply, you can reinforce behaviors, but check this out. If you get force and make a child sit down at a table, but in doing so, they felt mad at you, they didn't create like trauma. It, they had a negative mm-hmm. experience mm-hmm. and they got pissed off. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about the child. Mm-hmm. Here's what you've just done in the neurology. This is biology, guys. I'm talking science. You've just paired a negative experience yes. with sitting at a table. You've just paired a negative experience with sitting at a table. That's biology. That's science. It's not psychology. Mm-hmm. It's how we pair events. That's how people get phobias, right? Mm-hmm. We have phobias of
trauma. When trauma happens.
Trauma.
Yes.
Okay. So you can't, as an educator and behaviorist, you can't ignore biology mm-hmm. because it's just a fact. And you can't ignore the feeling that a child has as you're working with them, or the relationship, however you want to phrase it, you can't ignore it. Why? Because it's physiological. It's right there. It's happening. And so you must address that, mm-hmm. that piece. Right. So I'm just throwing that out as well mm-hmm. as something. By the way, here's just an interesting little footnote. In my research for the book, and just over the years, as they say, I've read a lot of different things. And Lovaas, the grandfather, you really got to know a lot about behavioral science to help these kids. But I was able to see, and they're available publicly, some videos of Lovaas himself working with children early on. Mm. And I will tell you, and this has been written about a number of times, by the way, it's not just my opinion, but I really think that he had a gift with kids. Mm. I think he was one of those therapists that you'd come along and go, I want him on my team. Mm-hmm. He would get down low. He would, you know, take some time with the kids. He seemed charming. He seemed sincere. He apparently was really quite gifted with working with kids.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you that. And I saw it from my own eyes in the video. What saddens me is that he never, that I can find, didn't write about that something that he had.
The connection.
Mm-hmm. Maybe didn't reflect on, hey, you know what? Part of what I'm doing here with kids and why we got some great results is I felt a real connection with them, or I really loved them, or I opened my heart, or I was gentle, or I looked at them with kindness, or whatever he might have written. But instead, it was just purely the behavioral, do these trials and do it this way. Mm-hmm. And I think, unfortunately, the legacy that he's passed on is that pure behavioral piece without this piece that I actually think that he really had.
The how. Mm-hmm. He missed a lot of the how. And I say that a lot. It's not the what, it's the how. And it's not, it's
that's the how, that's what you were saying.
That's what I've always said about ABA. When people are like, oh, how do I know if ABA is the right choice? And I said, it's not always the what, because the what can be the right fit. It's the how it's done. And that to any therapy, like mm-hmm. kids, people have had bad,
any
had
therapy bad, that let's just even right, get off the ABA right. thing, you know, I mean,
part because there's so many hours, like you're talking about, like when people are full-time ABA, you're talking about 20, 40 hours a week that kids are with this, and they can be there. Even if they have multidisciplinary, it's like their overarching therapy. That's like the home base mm-hmm. to everything else that goes back into synchronicity of like working all together with, and that's the harmony you want. You're going for a harmonious thing. And I think that's your approach. And that's the end result that you're looking for. If you are recommending the multidisciplinary, multi-treatment approach, even if it's not necessarily just in terms of timing of like, it's not always prerequisite. And I wanted to actually kind of mention that too, that it's not ABA thing of first this and then that. It's not always that. It's not a linear approach. There's not like this perfect trajectory. And you did actually end up mentioning that too in the book, I believe, regarding disciplinary and where you're talking about behavior or the
Yeah. Well, there's not a linear approach. It is somewhat linear in this sense, which is we do teach that you want to pay attention to what you would do first and what you would do second. And what you do third, and you want to pay attention to when you would start number two mm-hmm. and when you would stop number one, for example. So mm-hmm. order and timing in that way. It's not linear in this sense though, which is it's different for every child. Mm-hmm. So there is, you're right. There's not a formula or a pattern that you follow. And there are some things that are complementary that we do together mm-hmm. at the same time. Your child would go to this lesson and that. And there are some things that are contraindicatory that you wouldn't do together. But Natasha, you said something that's so golden for parents to hear, truly, truly. So I just want to repeat it again, because we're all talking about it's the how, not mm-hmm. necessarily what. For families that I'm not simply not able because of resources or time or capacity to work with them, and they say, Jonathan, please just one kind of tip, where should we start? What should we do? And if I really don't have the ability or capacity to go through that intake and plan it out for them, I'll pass on this one tip. It's exactly what you said, Natasha, which is at the end of the day, it doesn't matter really that much mm-hmm. if you go and do play-based at sunrise or hardcore discrete trial training, ABA, or you want to go and do this. It doesn't matter really that much when do early start Denver model, floor time. They help lots of kids. Mm-hmm. Here's what really matters. Go out and don't interview for a type of program. Go out and find the absolute best child whisperer therapist that you can find. Mm. And if they happen to be doing ABA, awesome. If they happen to be doing the Early Start Denver model, the Sunrise program, the IMTI model, go and interview for someone that knows kids, that connects with kids, that is playful, that is loving, that is kind, that is inspired, that has experience. Go find that person and don't worry so much about what elk they come, you know, sort of the background that they come from in terms of the style. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Come on. I mean, just a How did perfect find example that of that is
that's the unicorn.
You're asking. Well, right. And so that's a great thing. And so then we need a profile of what that person is, and you need some questions, right? With the families that I work with, I have it written down. I have it written here's some interview questions that you ask when you're interviewing people like this, if you're able to. I know some people go to a service provider and they don't get to pick who's working with their child. Mm-hmm. But I try and empower parents and say, you know, you're your child's advocate. You know that. You're your child's voice. You know that. And so if you go to ABC Autism Learning Center, don't let them just assign people to your child. Say, happy to work with you. Love to bring my business to you. I want to be part of the interview process of all the people that will be actually interacting with my child. Here's my five questions that I'm going to use. Mm-hmm. And among those questions are less about, you know, what's your education level? What school did you go to? What's your approach? And it's how do you deal with a child in a tantrum? That's one of the questions on the list, because it tells me almost everything. Are they comfortable with it? Do they understand crying is natural? Are they going to be compassionate? How do they deal with it? But do they have a strategy? And there's a couple of other questions. But I think you're right. Is let's empower parents to be able to interview and select, you know, good, top people, not just because they're sort of walking and have two lungs and they're breathing and they have a good intention, but you know, are you that person with that insight into that kind of just. Kids want to go on a piggyback ride and do things with you because you're that kind of person. That's who I'm looking for.
Mm-hmm. Our interim superintendent shows that. Are you a kid magnet?
And
are you a kid magnet?
Well, and it all goes back to you knowing your child, observing your child, really, really observing your child in the home, in you know, out in public. Like, what are all the things? What's not just like, you know, they don't behave in public, or, you know, how are they connecting with the different people in your home? Is there somebody that's, you know, one parent's more softer than the other? And so the child really, you know, has a better connect. I mean, it's just so much bigger than just this, you know, and it even goes to show, like, my son Jack is no longer in any therapies outside of school, but he's still doing occupational therapy and speech therapy. And he's in fourth grade. And we've had a gamut of different therapists, and he's done really awesome one school year. And then the next, you know, not that he did horrible, but he just did not connect. He was not connecting with the person. They probably had great intentions. They probably had great therapy tactics and skills, but he didn't have the rapport with them.
And remember, I feel like our autistic kids are energy sensitive too. And so I think, again, when you're talking about Lavas, about his heart was there and it was his how, right? And that ability to connect, it's sensing the authenticity. So you can't deliver these types of therapies and expect the reciprocated response or the learning response, or without really truly being authentic in what it is that you're doing, and in an empathetic way that individual still is able to identify with you, which is, again, it goes back to all of those practices, all of those other practices that, again, it's not just one way. Like, it's not just the floor-based play-based model, or the sunrise model, or the ABA model, or any of those particular models. There's merit in all of them that you can definitely take away for sure. That definitely segued into progress, but it could be missing certain pieces that aren't necessarily fulfilling the whole thing for your child holistically.
Well, we're back to the how. And so you'd say that unless your child is learning purely digitally, like just on a computer screen, 100% of other learning is done through another human being, a teacher, a grandparent, a sports coach, whatever. There's another human there. And again, therefore, the human, the teacher, the ABA therapist, whoever, is a dynamic. They're a variable in your child's world, in your child's learning. And so therefore, we have to consider who that person is, how they are being. Mm-hmm. And I'll just add an idea here. that addresses exactly what you're saying. This is directly from, I'm giving you some insight from our therapist training program. So, you know, work with parents, do all of what we talked about, and then train teams. And there's four principles that I work with. And the very first principle, and I'll tell you what it is, you can write it down, just if it's interesting to you, it's that attitude impacts behavior. Attitude impacts behavior. Very similar concept to learning as a biological process, which is how I'm feeling. And you were talking, Jean, about that, you know, children can pick up on energy, let's say, or people can pick up on energy. And I want to just for a moment make that very tangible for us. Because for some people, they're going to hear that, oh, I don't pick up on energy. What does that mean? Are they psychic? Let's just bring that depth. By the way, I agree with you 100%, but I want to put some biology in it because it's true. What you said is true. And here's the science behind it, okay? Which is this, is attitude impacts behavior. How we feel has a physiological echo in our body that impacts how we behave. Right? Mm-hmm. Case in point, when you're frustrated with your child, when you're frustrated with your husband, when you're frustrated with your boss, that's a feeling that you're having. Comes from a thought, right? Why did he leave his shoes there again? Why didn't he come home on time? Why is my child asking me so many questions? Whatever your thought is that leads to a feeling, and a feeling is a physiological cascade of neurochemicals. We know that. If you have fear, then you have certain chemicals that are released from your brain that make your pupils dilate and your heart beat faster. And when you have that loving feeling and you have different kinds of neurochemicals go through your body and your blood pressure lowers and you soften. Mm-hmm. It's a physiological. Feelings have a physiological impact. There's a great book by a PhD researcher named Candace Pert called Molecules of Emotion. And she was trying to map out what are the neurochemicals of emotions. But what's important here, guys, is those thoughts and feelings then translate to our behavior. So if you're impatient, you're darn right, you can hear it in mom's voice. So the verbal behavior is shifted. Mm-hmm. If you're angry, that's, you're probably going to stomp a little bit harder across the floor or across the kitchen. If you're feeling playful, we can see and hear that. So when we say a child kind of feels energy, I think they literally see how you're feeling in your behavior. And sometimes, by the way, it's very, very subtle. Like when you're pushing a child up to the kitchen table or a desk and you just snug them in a little bit too much because you're impatient that they're getting out of the chair a lot. And that little tuck in that I'm kind of right. Whoa, the desk is right up to my chest. I'm 2.5 years old, 3 years old, whatever. I've been tucked in to this desk and that was done with impatience and I could feel it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So what this brings us back to is when I train therapists and teachers and parents, we have this discussion so that we all know that our emotions and our thoughts about this child and the process and ourselves, by the way, the guilt we feel, the anger we feel, when we look up at the heavens and say, why do I have this life? Why was I cursed? Or whatever the feelings are, all of those thoughts and feelings are channeled into the behavior I have with the child. Mm-hmm. And if you understand that, then the next step is, okay, when we do training and when we do goal setting and IEP work and that kind of stuff, we should probably decide on how we want to feel and what we want to think. We actually prescribe it. This might be sound crazy, but we do some stuff in our program that's kind of there. And we say, okay, guys, so we're going to help this little guy learn to put on his shoes. That's our goal. And we use this shoe tying strategy. Are we going to do the bunny rabbit ears? Or are we going to do the over and under? We'll pick the strategy. And are we going to use laces that are kind of waxy or ones that are colored? How can we motivate him to want to tie his shoes? And so we'll do that. And then we will say, and what's the thought that we all want to hold in our mind as we're doing this? Do we want to think tying laces is fun? Do we want to think this is easy? Do we want to think you can do this? Do we want to think I'll be patient and we can take as much time as you need? Mm-hmm. Let's all have a thought, like a group think. And then what's the feeling we want to have? So for example, if I'm teaching a child about science, I might want to adopt a curiosity feeling as a teacher because I want the child to be curious, to learn how to have curiosity. Why would this be happening? Why? Look, we drop a stone in the lake and it has ripples. What the heck is that about? And if it's maybe physical skills, I might want to have a feeling of enthusiasm or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. So we literally start to look at in an IEP, not just the behavioral goals, but how the educators and teachers and adults think and feel that are aligned with achieving that goal. Mm. And I think that kids pick up on that.
That is,
because they see it.
Adults pick up on it.
That is, you just gave some profound insight to approach to goal setting. That not even an educator that we've had on here or any other medical professional has given insight to that can really transform the way that how exactly that is actually literally thinking about how you want it done.
Jean, we have a column on our goal setting IEP list. We have a column that is labeled attitude, and it's a therapist attitude, and we prescribe, we give suggestions. It's right in the actual document. And I say to the therapists and our people, check this out. I'll just give you this piece, which is in the same way that we try and hold the child accountable, right? We collect data points. Mm-hmm. Did he draw the circle 7 times and whatever? We hold ourselves accountable. Was I patient? Mm-hmm. Was I feeling curiosity? Was I feeling love? Was I feeling enthusiasm? And we check in with each other. Hey, how did that session go with little Jason? Oh, it went well. He was running around. He didn't sit down. We only got to draw 3 circles. Cool. How are you feeling? How'd you do?
I
have that conversation, and we do training around that, by the way.
I want to say one thing just because I've been sitting and soaking in all of this, mm-hmm. Partially because my husband was hammering in the other room. So I stayed on mute and listened, but, he was very kind and quit when I asked. So let me throw that out in case he's listening. But you brought up something right there that I love, because I am always looking at things that I can do differently in the home, not just, you know, with therapy and all of that. And my word for 2024 this year is intentionality in everything, because I tend to be, my naturopath would not like the way I'm about to say this, but I tend to be a higher anxiety human being. She would not like that I'm labeling myself, but we're just going to go with it. And a lot of that is because I don't plan everything intentionally. And so I have tried to be more intentional this year in my time with Gracie, she's 8.5. But one thing that you said that I really liked is, when I'm going into that time with her where I want to be fully present and intentional, one thing that I think I'm going to apply now is, okay, what is my end game at the end of this 15 minutes, 30 minutes, you know, what am I trying to achieve in this time? And how do I want it to feel for her during this time? Like, really love that piece of it, because, and I think that kind of bounces back to like Sunrise program and joining and, you know, that sort of thing we talked about on Zoom. And that I think is really, really helpful. So thank you for saying that, because I think, you know, there's so much that we try to do at home, and there's so much, we put a lot of pressure on ourselves as parents, as mothers, in ways that we show up for our kids, and we're always trying to figure out how we can be better. And so I think you pointing that out is really big. And that is something like I underlined intentionality in.
That's huge. And that's huge. You're talking about what we would call the learning process. So there's and you guys all know, we've all seen fridge magnets that say, it's not the destination, it's the journey. You know that fridge magnet?
Yes.
That's what you're talking about, Janet. That's what you're talking about, which is, you know, I have an intention, let's say, is often, again, on the behavior. I want my child to sit down and eat for 5 minutes before they take off. I want my child to chew slower tonight, the behavior. And we don't often have an intention on the experience. The experience of that meal, whether I achieve the goal or not. Right? That's like, you know, and so I think, you know, I gave the example of, you could ultimately, there's lots of strategies. There's thousands, hundreds of strategies on YouTube on how to get a kid to sit at a table. Mm-hmm. The question I always have is, was that paired with a nice experience or not a nice experience? Mm-hmm. And that's so critical, because it's probably going to determine if the child ever sits at a table or not. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The experience of it, not the actual achievement of sitting. And so when we place as parents and therapists and educators, when we place at least half, if not more, of our intention, to use your word, on the experience that the child will have, something shifts, Shannon, and this is so exciting of what you said, which is, I behave differently. Mm-hmm. You're going to behave differently. If your intention is around, I want us both to have somewhat of an enjoyable experience of this car ride. Mm-hmm. That's actually my superseding, my main objective here. And if she kicks the back of the seat a couple of times, I want to stop that. My intention is for her to have a car ride without kicking the back of the seat or yelling at her brother, but I want us to enjoy it together. Mm-hmm. And what starts to happen is your behavior as a parent shifts so that you can actually get the goals of not kicking the back of the seat and not yelling at brother in a much more effective way, because you're now attractive. Mm-hmm. As opposed to the unattractive parent or the unattractive educator. You're actually someone she wants to listen to. Mm-hmm. You're actually someone that he feels is kind of partly on his team, or at least he's having some fun with. Mm-hmm. And so we want to listen to that adult. Mm-hmm. Your success rate goes up.
I think that's so mm-hmm. true. And in mm-hmm. the same vein, because I had this experience on Monday at my son's Special Olympics basketball practice. And this was an interaction between me and another parent. I had my daughter with me, and I should say it was Tuesday night. And she was being extremely helpful. She's like a little mini little coach in training, and she's younger than Rory. And she started to kind of refusing to help because she was saying she was tired. Well, this other parent chimed in. She was trying to be helpful to me, like, oh, why don't you go help your brother? Like your mom asked and all this stuff. And then we got into this dialogue about, you know, rewards and consequences. And mind you, again, this is all children with disabilities. This particular parent's child is a teenager and she has Downs. And I said something about, she's like, well, Caden knows that there's consequences. And I said, well, I said, Rory and I guess McKenna, as a byproduct, I've never really done like punitive things as a result to reinforce behavior. And I also recognized in that moment too, which is why I think the mom was trying to help me in some way. She was, her intention was to be helpful, is I was tired. And there's a lot of times, especially in my certain realm of life, where I realize that if I don't have the capacity or agency, I'm not going to quote unquote hold the demand or make the request of my kid, because it's not going to come from a good place. It's probably going to do more harm than good. I'm not saying I always do that all the time, but there are definitely times where I'm definitely being cognizant of that. And here I found myself trying to explain this to the parent. Like, I was like, well, yeah, we just, you know, punitive stuff, just if anything, would escalate Rory's behavior. And then McKenna called me out, and the girls already know this because we've talked about this on the podcast. There's one thing that I do that, just because sometimes there's a safety issue or I have to get immediate compliance because of a safety issue or timing or whatever. And I'm like, I'm going to throw your iPad in the trash. He knows it's an empty threat, but he still responds to it, you know, and times like, oh, no, thank you. Right. He immediately responds to it. Like, not saying I recommend that. That is not the point of it, but I'm just saying like, I think there's a balance. Sometimes a parent, and I'm sure educators are teachers, are in this situation. And you did talk about that in this book too, like, you know, in the inclusion conversation, and you had a whole room of teachers speak up of like, why this is so much better. And then you get challenged or thinking anymore. And then they express what their limitations are. You know, those limitations environmentally do exist. And as long as it sounds like this is what happens with this process that you put in place, is that you become home base for a broker of honest conversation around all of these things to say, this is how this should probably be facilitated. We shouldn't probably incorporate all of these things if the parent's agency or the therapist agency or the educator's agency is limited in these capacity, if they are not able to execute it in such a way, or if the data comes back saying, well, we didn't do, let's say if you're doing trial-based therapy, we didn't do these X amount of trials because my attitude and my approach was not going to be within the right conditions to execute that. I don't think that any of us as parents truly, like even myself, I can't say that I've ever really looked at it at a that scientific way of evaluating goals, of evaluating what's next. I think intuitively within our group of four moms, I think we do that as our peer-to-peer support to each other. I think that we do that, like, but we don't know that that's actually what we're doing, but you've now given us language for us to do it. And I'm sure now we can even be more intentional and more amazing in developing our kids' educational and treatment plans. But I think you gave us like the biggest tool in our tool belt today. It was completely unexpected, but it's probably one of the most powerful things that I feel like we can.
Beautiful. Beautiful. Mm-hmm. It's empowering to you. I just want to say attitude impacts behavior. Mm-hmm. Those of you who are listening today, please don't take the idea and judge yourself with it.
Yes.
Don't weaponize it, yes, as we say in the news these days. Mm-hmm. So you don't say, oh my gosh, I already have a lot to do. Now I've got to be happy all the time. And if I'm not, I'm, you know, wrecking my kids' development. Who the heck is this guy? That's not what we're saying.
Right.
We want to empower you to say that how you feel, your emotions, is one of your greatest resources. Mm-hmm. Two good news is it's free. You don't have to pay for it. you can feel impatient and happy and sad and joyful, whatever, at your will, no cost, no subscription. It's already built in. And secondly, it's a renewable resource. You can't run out of good feelings or happiness or patience. With that said, and it's you, you don't have to go get training necessarily, although we do a lot of attitudinal training. But if you're a mom sort of saying, well, what the heck can I do today? One thing you could do is look at some of those beliefs we talked about, yes, the limiting beliefs. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we talk about it in the book. You can find I'm not the only one talking about a different sort of framework around autism, but you could look at your feelings and that, but please don't weaponize it and beat yourself up. So be patient with yourself, be loving with yourself, be kind to yourself in the same patience and love and kindness you extend to your autistic child and say, mm-hmm, I'm trying my best. I think what we talked about today is intentionality. So if that's new for you, just go, oh my gosh, this is another variable I can think. That's terrific. Here's one quick, Shannon, can I give you a quick, based on your comment, a technique, a strategy that we use? Please. Very simple. Again, free. You don't have to go get training. And it's just adding your emotional intention into your commands to your child. Mm. I'll say it again. There's a tip. And it's quite interesting. So instead of saying, okay, guys, let's go. Let's get in the car. We pause and we say to a parent, well, what would be your intention of the experience you want them to have getting in the car in order to make it easier? And you say, well, I guess I'd want them to enjoy it, let's say. So here's what the command sounds like. Okay, guys, let's get ready. We want to enjoy getting in the car. And you literally put it right in your command. Hey, guys, come on. We got to go and have fun putting on our shoes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What? Mm-hmm. We got to go have fun putting on. I'm telling you, little kids' brains go, ooh, that sounds cool. Mm-hmm. Let's go have fun. And they're going to be a bit sillier. Okay, we're going to put on our shoes. And they kind of get silly. But that's what I want. I want them instead of like, oh, I don't want to put on my shoes or you know, resisting. Mm-hmm. So when you start throwing in these, what we call suggestions in psychology, auto-suggestions, is, you know, you meet someone and you say, hey, thanks for, you know, doing this job for me. I really feel confident that you're going to do it very well. Mm-hmm. You're suggesting to someone, right? Tony Robbins uses this as well, by the way, in lots of different psychologists. But it works really nicely with kids. Instead of, hey, guys, come on, let's go. Dinner served. Mm-hmm. Hey, guys, come on. Come on over to dinner so we can, mm-hmm, have a terrific conversation together. Mm-hmm. Terrific conversation together. It's bedtime. What could bedtime become? Right? Instead of just it's bedtime. Go brush your teeth.
Jonathan,
what could go brush
you
your teeth
over?
Become
no,
instead
fair,
of just go
children,
brush your
please.
Teeth?
Please.
I know, right?
I'm in deep. I'm searching for a co-parent.
You're searching for a co-parent. Come on,
I'm
parent together for a day.
I know I'm not weaponizing that. I'm not weaponizing against myself, but I definitely That's now right. even more so recognize, like, even in those basic fundamental tasks, which I have felt terrible about. I felt terrible about, like, the whole those transition periods. Yeah. Because you're talking about setting emotions around all of those transition periods of, like, the request. And those
right?
are so tough because I'm trying to keep them safe. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to keep them on time. You're juggling all of these other variables. You have all this
right.
mental load
right.
as a parent. And now you want me, mm-hmm. this is, I mean, like, the buzzword is, like, gentle parenting, but it is like, this is like gentle parenting actually broken down in a scientific level, right? And especially specific to our neurodivergent kids. So, like, I just, my terrible parent.
Kind of, yeah.
Well,
I mean, that's another conversation. Yeah. I'm actually, I don't sign up entirely for a gentle parent. And if you watch me with children, the people I work with in parenting, I'm pretty really super clear about limitations, mm-hmm. and I'm really into consequences. And we could have, if you want, a conversation all around it. How do you do that, especially with kids with autism? And I could lay some of that stuff out. I think the idea, though, is I 100% need my kids to put on their shoes, and I know that children like to play, and I know that they're more open to people that get them, and they're not that open to parents who are impatient. That's mm-hmm. just what I know. It's mm-hmm. just a fact. And so how do I coach myself, right? I'm already overwhelmed in the day. I'm already at a level that is challenging for me. So the tip for Shannon is if you build in just even the language mm-hmm. that you're even reminding yourself and your kids, hey guys, let's go have fun getting in the car. Mm-hmm. Even if when I say that sentence kind of gets me a little bit more mm-hmm. in that range. Mm-hmm. So we can all get there. Anyway,
this is the best way to end this
Let's
episode.
So good.
It is. Perfect.
And it also leaves a lot on the table for us for our next episode to discuss, obviously, clearly. And at that point, too, we will also dive into your online instrument. I'll call it an instrument. How do you want to mm-hmm. do you want to call,
sure,
it?
Yeah,
okay. call it? Do you call it? Do you the assessment tool? How do you?
Thrive Guide. Okay. The Thrive Guide. Yeah.
The yeah, Thrive Guide, we'll break that down so that we can, obviously, we're letting you know that it exists, so you can go to it now if you want, but to actually get more of an explanation and how it was all, how it all came to be, and what its purpose and function does, and we'll discuss that on the next episode for sure, but this has been like, we were all...
Sure. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for the conversation, guys.
So good.
Really,
thank you.
Yes.
I love talking with you.
Next love time. Talking with you.
The third
and you're doing awesome
is
work.
Margaritas. So.
Their meeting is Margaritas. That's right. Yeah. Margaritas in Texas.
Yeah.
Margaritas in Texas. Yeah. Okay, guys. Thank you very much.
Don't leave us yet. So we're going to sign off. You know, we're going to sign off to our community. We always give the reminders about where to find us on Instagram at Moms Talk Autism. You can also please leave us a review on anywhere by our podcast player, but mostly our Apple, our iTunes is where most of our reviews are set. That helps other families find us. And then if you have any suggestions or questions, again, send a message to hello at Moms Talk Autism or into our DMs. And until next time, we know you're on the edge of your seat for the next episode now. thanks for staying with us and we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, guys.
Bye, guys.